I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
We're talking Tech Hunt on 870 The Flyway.
We're in the blind now, loading our guns and scanning the sky for the first flock of ducks to appear.
As far as the 27-year-old, I didn't even own a pair of hit boots all winter.
There's a flock now. Looks like about 25 balance.
What kind of gun did you use?
Freaking 12-gauge, what do you think?
You're listening to 870 The Flyway, your duck and goose hunting podcast.
Canvasback Duck Club.
Canvasback? When I was a fighter, that's what they called me. I was on the canvas so much, I used to stand like that. Not for long.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Ordinarily, we're going to open up on ducks that are all of a half mile away.
Do you have any idea when the last time somebody won the world with a wooden duck hole?
We're hovering over the decoys. Okay, let him have it.
Did you shoot any?
Yes, like 50 of them.
Three ducks hit the water with a resounding splash.
I don't know who did it, but I know one thing they're saying.
On 870, The Flyway.
The Flyway. Welcome. Gordy Gordon here, your host, and for the next 15 minutes, we're in for a treat. One of the most informed, one of the most successful guys in the duck call industry is our guest today. Stay tuned. Three-time world duck calling champion Barney Califf is next with Calling with Califf right here on 870 The Flyway. Barney is not only a world champion duck caller, but one of the most approachable and friendly guys you'll ever meet in the waterfowl industry. Today, we're going to be talking about a variety of topics, including how we, the mere mortal duck callers, can do a better job of calling out in the field. But this freewheeling look at whatever Barney wants to talk about, turn it over to the man, Barney Califf. Thanks for being here, Barn.
Gordy, how are you, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for being with us. Well,
hey,
how...
that intro, man, that's some high praise. And everybody knows I'm a duck hunter and a duck caller and a hell of a nice guy.
Yeah.
But I am a kick-ass bass fisherman, too. You left that out.
I was going to say that you're the second-best bass fisherman in Washington, Iowa, but that, you know,
yeah.
I don't know anything about that.
I know where you're going with that.
Uh-huh.
I'll just drop it.
I've got the hammer for that.
Yeah, you do. Yeah,
tell
you
me
do.
About it, brother.
It was weird. It was mild early, which is kind of typical for my region, we'll say. But South Dakota opens relatively late, so it closes heck, in early January. So you're going to get the weather sometime during the season. The week of Veterans Day, we had a good storm come through, a big cold front. And finally, my hunting partners are able to take time off during the week. And I'm retired, obviously, so I can. And we went up and spent 4 days there and shot some ducks, but not like we expected. In 4 days, I never looked up and saw 24 mallards hanging in the decoys. And our buddy my old host and that built my duck blind, he hunted 3 miles downriver from us. And in those 4 days, they shot 88 mallards. So what happened is that marsh, because of sedimentation, has pushed down into the lake and has extended the hunting area, we'll say, since I started up there in 87, mm-hmm. It has moved 3 miles downriver. So it's just an enormous amount of cover down there.
Wow.
I think what happens is those birds don't come up the river regularly like they used to. They'll cut short of town and go out north to feed that way, and we don't even see them. But if you're down that way, obviously, when they're coming back in, you know, you shoo them up. So I don't know what happened, honestly. And we went back out and did okay. Each time we shot a lot of geese. I mean, we weren't complaining about that. I love shooting honkers,
uh-huh.
But I'm a duck guy. And, you know, you got the perfect scenario. It's 25 degrees, and you got a west or a northwest wind blowing 15 miles an hour and sunshine. I mean, it's the table set. Mm-hmm. We just lacked the ducks up in the area we hunted. Ultimately, what happened is we thought, well, we better get back out there. Well, we looked at the forecast, and it was season-ending cold, below zero highs, a couple foot of snow. So it was done. We knew that. We didn't even go back out. We closed the place up and lost a month of the season.
Wow. Well, that's disappointing, man. How often does that happen to you since 87?
First time ever.
First time ever. Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible.
I'm lucky.
How are you coping with the withdrawals? I mean, I think I'd be, you know, chewing on the furniture or something.
I am, Gordy. One of the things that I'm battling, or a couple of things, is obviously that whole duck thing is got me frustrated. And of course that duck boat sitting out in the yard, still for sale. And then of course the bass boat's parked over here in the side of the garage. And so I'm thinking fishing now because I've written off the duck season. So I'm stir crazy right now. Bad.
I bet so. You're not an ice fisherman.
I am. I just haven't got out.
I see.
Yeah. I don't know why. I mean, I've got all the time in the world, and my wife certainly does. She's willing to go. So
we're talking with Barney Califf on 870 The Flyaway. We'll be right back. And we're back with Barney Califf on 870 The Flyaway. Thanks for being with us, Barn. We just heard a little bit about your season and the disappointment of that. There's really, outside of picking up and moving, you know, lock, stock, and barrel down the river or whatever, is there anything you can do about that next time or next year?
There is. Again, we have buddies that have a place up there also, and we team up when we can. That first particular trip when he was shooting all those ducks, I would have absolutely picked up and motored down there, but he had already set up in a double boat setup. There was five of them, and he won't hunt more than three out of his boat.
Yeah.
Consequently, I didn't want to go down in there and impose, and I have a three boat setup. You know, when you've got 60 foot of duck blind, you better know what you're doing, and you better keep quiet. But again, if it was just him, Gory, I can't tell you how quick I'd have picked up and motored down.
Great. Well, maybe this will be a one-off for you then, in all the years of your camp up there. What accounted for the increase in the geese? Do you think, was it just the weather pushed more down for you, or what?
Yeah, the weather pushed a bunch down. You know, we always get a push of Canada's typically with the mallards, but this time there was considerably more geese present than we're used to. And a lot less of them. Even the guys that were downriver, even though they were shooting ducks, they weren't seeing the numbers that you would expect with that weather we had.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, a lot of Canadas pushed in. Consequently, we set up specifically to kill Canadas, and we threw a few duck decoys out too.
Yeah. Well, that's a good strategy for, I found, for down here in the middle latitudes. Because they, you know, by the time they get to us, they've seen three dozen decoys, you know, in every configuration, and 16 spinners in every configuration they possibly can. But that's another story for another day. Tell me this, I know from talking with you at the trade show up in Wisconsin that you're working on, or had in the works, a new iteration of your outstanding product, Calling Ducks My Way. How's that going?
It's going. It's funny you should bring that up. He is supposed to call me today with the proof. He had to scan some things because I ordered some DVDs also, just because it's still on my website.
Right.
But he was going to also digitize it and get that in the works, and send me an email today so I can get the link set to my web designer and get that thing uploaded onto the site. So
yeah,
it
holy
will be available probably in the next few days.
Excellent. Well, turn off the phone and go do that right now. No, I'm kidding.
No, we'll do this.
If it only works. But okay. But the disc is outstanding. I've heard it. I haven't lived it yet, but I've heard it, and anyone can learn to call ducks with that instruction. Tell me what it is that what it is that most duck hunters do wrong, or where do we go wrong whenever we are out there in the field trying to bring that bunch of mallards in or whatever. The mistakes that are made are by what?
The biggest mistake is hunters calling at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. I don't cover that in the instructional. That mine is strictly operation.
Okay.
And so what I've done is I was blessed with enough God-given ability to mimic. And so I can pick up a duck call, listen to a sound a guy makes, and duplicate that sound. So calling came easy to me. Matter of fact, real easy. I told everybody I play by ear, and they say, well, who taught you? And I said, well, I was self-taught with some instruction from Wendell Carlson. He had an instructional system that was complicated and cumbersome, but it did make sense if you could understand it. He always said it takes intelligence, talent, and commitment to be a good call operator. And I learned quickly that the talent part played a lot bigger role than I thought. Now that said, I put a lot of thought into this instructional because I didn't want to put one out that was just so-so and then improve on it the next year and improve on it the next year. I wanted an all-encompassing instructional that made sense and was easy to understand. And I'm a king of shortcuts. And so I thought of a lot of ways to help people in certain aspect parts that are normally tough. I made easy. And quite honestly, the very basic start of it is to learn how to quack and then build off of that. And I've got keywords to help them, things like that. And I can take an individual, and I think, Gordy, I think you've actually witnessed it. Bring them into the booth, get them a call, and I'll have them quacking in just, a few minutes. And then you build that quack into a hen greeting. The hen greeting is the call that you want to take to the field.
Right.
There's feed calls and hail calls and comeback calls and all that stuff. But what I talk about is if you want to kill ducks, you got to sound like Mama Duck. And the reason I say this, again, I've thought about a lot of this stuff. And I witnessed one spring on a golf course pond by home, ducks just trucking along out of the pond, and they're heading out onto the golf course. And Mama Duck was leading them. Well, some of them would straggle back behind her. And she would stand there and rear up, real tall, and bark out that hen grin. She'd go, bang, 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 bang. And man, they would scurry over to her. And I watched that and I went, I ain't no dummy. That's the sound you want to make.
There you go.
And quite honestly, in that scenario, that was a comeback call. It was get back here or get in here. So, what I explain is the hen greeting that is so required to kill ducks is also the comeback call. And the only difference is when you blow it. If they're on their way in, it's a greeting. If they're on their way out, it's a comeback call.
All right. But you mentioned the error that we make, the novices or the uncommitted guys like me who haven't really learned how to blow a duck call properly. The mistake we make is the timing of when we call.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go right in. Let's talk a little bit more about that. We've all heard, call them on their wingtips or whatever, and that's okay if you can visualize that, but go ahead and give us your take on that.
That's a good take. Wingtips and tail feathers. I've always called it armpits. When you can see the back of the wing where it attaches to the duck, that's when you want to blow the duck call. Biggest mistake when I said calling at the wrong time, can I blow a duck call and demonstrate this?
Of course. Please do. That's why we're here, buddy.
The biggest mistake I see guys make is, let's say they've got a flock of ducks out 500 yards, and they hit them a lick, and they hit them a lick, and boy, they turn. They're coming their way, 125 yards, I call is my sphere of influence. At 125 yards, the guy picks up his call and he goes, and those birds lock up and they're starting to sail towards the decoys. Here's the mistake. Right there. They start blowing a 24 karat feed call that is for a contest stage. And if the ducks may still come in, but I'm betting that you're putting them on alert. The way I try to summarize it when I'm talking to folks about this is you called them from 500 yards away at 125. You did the absolute best thing. You hit them with a greeting call. They're sailing in. Yeah. I say, keep that call in your hand just in case, but I'd slide one hand over on that shotgun when they're locked up.
Right, right.
And that's reading birds now. See what they're going to do. If they come in, it's pretty simple. If they swing the decoys and start to leave, you shoot them in the armpit with the duck call and bring them back around.
Right, right. Well, let's take a break right there, and we'll be back with more from Colin with Califf, Barney Califf here on 870 The Flyway. And we're back with Barney Califf here on 870 The Flyway. Barney, we've been talking about when not to call. You've demonstrated a few calls for us, but I'm going to ask you to take off with that particular topic and talk about something, you know, that's at the top of your mind. You're out there, you're giving these seminars, and you're seeing what folks are doing, aren't doing, can and can't do. I'm going to turn it over to you and make it the Barney Califf show for the next bit, and I'll just be your Ed McMahon here.
I alluded earlier about my instructional DVD, soon to be downloadable off my website. I cover every topic you can imagine, every call you can make in the field, and simplify how to do it. And I've prided myself on the number of people that I have actually helped be pretty good duck callers. What I do, and some of you folks are going to listen to this and think this is third semester stuff. It is to some people. Other people find it highly invaluable, but I show them how to quack. And essentially you hum the word voot into the call, V-O-O-T, at the same time you open your hand. The air pressure is going to be dependent on how heavy the call is, but you're not going to overblow a quack 95% of the time. So I just start off, and as you open your hand up, you'll get a quack sound. If you open the hand too early, it's flat. Open it too late, and it's go whack. So open it early, open it late. Both of them are horrible quacks. A good quack. And again, I'm humming the word voot to understand the resonance. The O-O positions your throat open. And in this latest issue of Traditions Magazine, in my column, I explain this. Most hunters don't blow with an open enough throat to get good resonance. If you're closed-throated, open-throated, so concentrate most of the time. And when I say most of the time, there's not many times in duck calling that I don't blow open-throated. So the V-O-O-T, the V adds some resonance. The hum, as you hum this word, adds more resonance. The O-O positions the throat. And there you go. You got a quack. Now, some people would say, okay, man, we got this quack down. What are we doing with this quack? You take that quack and you put five of them together. There's your hen greeting and your comeback call. If you want to kill ducks, the hen greeting is your A number one call. You can forget all the fancy stuff, the hail calls, the feed calls, everything else. I seldom blow a feed call in the field. So take yourself a quack and a good hen greeting, and you'll be amazed at the amount of ducks that you'll kill. When I first started to get what I thought was good on a duck call, I could do this. And I shot some ducks, but I always noticed they were always coming my way when I did it. So did I call them in or did I not? I don't know. But gotcha. Once I learned, I turned into a duck killer instead of a duck hunter. My mentality switched where I would actually go out expecting to call and kill ducks as opposed to hope.
Duck hunters coast to coast are already choosing Duck Hunting Traditions magazine as their brand new favorite. Why? Because Traditions is 100% of the good stuff. All of the best things you love about waterfowl hunting with no politics, no fluff, and no BS. It's a classic hunting magazine like they used to have, jam-packed with readable page-turning stories from yesterday and today. And the writers are real waterfowl hunters. There's old-time ads and incredible vintage photos side-by-side with blazing color action shots taken by some of today's most talented photographers. Order Duck Hunting Traditions in January and you'll have a shot at prizes like a handmade Mitch Rogers duck call. Order today, DUCKMAGZ, that's duckmags.com.
You're listening to 870 The Flyway.
If you hunt waterfowl for very long, you're going to lose an item of gear. But what about whenever the loss is a treasured gift or heirloom trusted to your care? That ratchets up the emotional and actual loss up and off the charts into a gut-wrenching kick in the waders. Michael Harrison, age 27, of McGee, Mississippi, knows that feeling well. He endured an anxious hour in the duck woods pre-dawn the other morning up near Clarendon, Arkansas, and he has quite a story to tell about lost and found here on 870 The Flyway. Welcome, Michael. Tell us that story in your own words.
Yes, sir, I sure will. My name's Michael Harrison, and I was raised in McGee, Mississippi, and I've been duck hunting per se for probably around 10-12 years, and I ended up going to school at Arkansas Monticello, which is in the south of Arkansas, south side of Arkansas, and I was there for 2 years playing baseball there, and I ended up staying in Monticello for 3 more years after I graduated. So I've got the in-stater life and the out-of-stater life, but here recently I moved back to Mississippi. So this is going to be my second season back in Mississippi, but we bought a place on the south side of the White River in St. Charles, so we still hunt Arkansas a good bit, but I guess you'd say my permanent resident is back in Mississippi at the moment.
The story that you're about to tell, or the facts you're about to tell about what happened the other day, was that at your place there on the White River?
It was not. It was on the White River, yes, sir, but it was up in Clarendon is where it was.
State area.
Yes, sir, it was.
Why don't you share a little bit more about what happened and kind of take it from the top?
Yes, sir. For sure. Well, we left here that camp about 2 o'clock that morning to get up to Clarendon to where we can be up there at 4 for entry. And whenever we got up there, it was right after about a 10-inch rain that we had. I believe that was Monday. So I guess you'd say when you get water, here comes the people also. So we got there about, like I said, we left here at 2. So we got there about 2:30, 2:45, and there was probably already 30 people at the ramp. So anyway, it was a madhouse. I mean, there was people everywhere. We jumped out of the truck, started backing down the boats and everything, and we got everything loaded up. Well, we head up north, and we ended up hunting north of Clarendon for, I don't know, probably a 30-minute boat ride or whatever. Anyway, we get up there, we walk in the hole, and we start setting up the decoys, and we start getting ready for light, which we probably still got another 30 minutes, and I start feeling for my calls, and I could not find them. whatsoever. So automatically I started panicking because it's the older style PSO for number one. So there's three reasons really. Number two is I've got an 11-year-old lab and she doesn't hunt much anymore. She hunts about twice a year. Mm-hmm. And I've got four bands and all four bands are on this call lanyard. This call lanyard that I've got is my 1-year anniversary from my wife. So, we're talking about an old style alt. We're talking about four bands that my 11-year-old dog picked up. And then my 1-year anniversary duck call lanyard. Well, anyway, automatically, I was panicking. I didn't know where to start. I started backtracking. We ended up, there was eight of us. So everybody started looking. We didn't know what was going on. Couldn't find them anywhere. So we had one more guy coming back from the boat ramp. So I called him and I said, man, can you please check in my truck to see if I happen to leave my calls, which I didn't think I did because I was checking my read and everything in it that morning in the truck before we got to the ramp. So my buddy calls me back and he said, man, I can't find your calls anywhere.
Oh,
and I said, did you look in the truck? Did you look in the front seat, back seat, passenger seat? He said, yeah, I looked everywhere.
Yeah.
I said, if you don't mind, please look in the back of the truck just in case when I was grabbing my decoys for some odd reason, it fell off.
And, right.
He was like, no, I can't find them. And I was like, would please just look in the parking lot? Look in the parking lot. I said, somebody may have ran over them, but I mean, at least I'll have my lanyard or my crow bands.
Right.
So he calls me right back and he says, you need to see this. And automatically my mind just went to, you know, crushed in the parking lot. So he said, FaceTime me. So I FaceTimed him. Well, anyway, I don't know who did it, but I know one thing, they're a saint. They had found my duck calls, I'm assuming, beside my truck.
Uh-huh.
And they got them and hung them on the tongue of my trailer.
Oh, man.
And, I mean, you know, you get this, all you do is you hear all these horror stories, you know, out-of-state guys get treated such and such, in-state guys are like this and like that. Well, I've been on both sides of the ball, really. So, I mean, I lived in Arkansas for 5 years. So, I mean, I've had the in-state side of things, and I've also had the out-of-state side of things.
And
it's just kind of like the, I guess you'd say in life, the bad things get more magnified than the good thing. But there's still plenty of good in duck hunting. I mean, you see jesters all the time, but a lot of them don't get noticed. Yep. But I'll tell you one thing. I don't know who did it, but I mean, At that moment, I could have gave him $1,000 for it.
I guess so.
I mean, you know, it was just so special to me, you know, especially for somebody. I mean, if they had wanted to, they could have took the lanyard. You know, I mean, it's a Oak Creek Kennel lanyard, kangaroo leather lanyard that's right at $200. They could have kept it. You know, they could have kept an old style alt that they don't make anymore.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I mean, so.
Yeah. And the bands, yeah.
It was just a huge – it was – and the bands yesterday that I never would have got back, and especially with my dog being 11, you know, I mean, that'll never happen again. So that's why I ended up posting it on Facebook on the Arkansas Tiller Handle page was – I don't know who did it, but I figured that was probably the most concentrated duck hunting page.
Right.
And I just wanted to let them know, I mean, I appreciate it. And there was that was by far the best feeling that morning. And right after that, we ended up having one of the best hunts of the year that we had on that place. We ended up shooting 8 limits by 9:30 that exact morning. So, I mean, it was just a phenomenal morning all the way around. But,
oh man,
but I would have took my duck calls over that limit any day.
Man, I'm glad that that good Samaritan, so to speak, came by and put those keepsakes up there where you would find them and not necessarily be visible to the public as they went by. That was brilliant. So
it was. It was a major act of kindness.
Right, right. Absolutely. Michael, thank you for your time, and God bless
you,
brother.
Yes, sir. God bless you.
Good hunting in the future.
Sir, thank you so much.
You bet. Michael Harrison from Mississippi with a great story. I'm telling you what, the good guys are still in charge. We just don't have as good a PR maybe as the thugs do. So we need to up our game on that maybe. Thanks again,
yes,
Michael.
Sir.
All righty. It's a pretty rare waterfowler who hasn't at least daydreamed of hunting over live decoys. Mr. Clyde Bell, nearly 90 years as a market hunter and duck guide on the Illinois River, is going to tell us all about rigging out as many as 90, yes, 90 ducks and geese for live decoys back in the day. This is our segment called Old Timer Tales, the history of our sport and the words and phrases and memories of folks who were there back in the day.
Would a lot of duck hunters come in the fall?
Duck hunters come here from all over the world. I mean, even foreign countries.
Would they stay at the hotels, or would they live out camps?
Well, what couldn't stay at hotels stayed at private houses. I had quite a few of them right here in them upstairs rooms.
Would you take them out hunting?
Oh, yeah, sure. After when there wasn't any fishing, why, then I was taking these duck hunters out. And then we had a 90-day season, 3 months out of the year. And I had duck hunters from all over. I've got a list of them down there. From St. Louis, from Chicago, from New York, from Champaign, and Decatur, Springfield, every place.
How much would they pay a day?
And then days I got $5 a day for two guys. I could only handle two guys because I had a rowboat then and not no motor. And I had to row. That's when I done my 32-mile-a-day rowing and stuff. With two men in a boat and a big couple of sacks of decoys, rowed every place and thought nothing about it. I took out duck hunters from all over the country and Colorado. Guys come here from Colorado every year to go duck hunting with me.
About how many would come here per season to hunt?
Oh, Jesus, I'd say 100. That is, I had as much as 100. And then the boys in Bath, they had them too.
Were there a lot of people here who guided?
Oh, sure.
Was it mainly the commercial fishermen?
Well, the commercial fishermen, as a rule, when they wasn't fishing and the duck season was on, they'd be taking out duck hunters. Not only me, but the other commercial fishermen too. Rudolph, Red Rudolph, Harry was his right name, and Pete. Pete made a business of it, just like I did, taking out duck hunters. He also was captain of a 1,000-yard train.
Hey everybody, Gordy Gordon here, your host, stepping in to give you some more background about Mr. Clyde Bell, the gentleman you're hearing on this interview. Mr. Bell was pretty sharp, just shy of 90 at the time of this interview. He'd spent 82 years living off the Illinois River as a commercial fisherman, a market duck hunter, and a commercial guide for duck hunters as well. He fur trapped in the winter, collected mussel. Quite a varied lifestyle that he led. Very typical of the time, the late 19th century, early 20th century, along the Illinois River in northern Illinois.
Those days, you not only could hunt around the borders of those lakes, but down, you know, the little town of Bath, from there on down, they had what they call field pens. Dig up a pretty fair-sized little pond there, put a wire fence in it, and you could use live decoys, and you'd have live ducks. They used a special kind of a duck. They used to breed a certain kind of a duck that was half tame duck and half wild duck, and they called them English colors. They would quack and what they call worked a lot better than the others. And they'd put them maybe all the way from a dozen to, I knew of one pen one time had as many 90 of those decoys. And you put them out in the pen and then you could dig pits in the ground back away from that. Or some of them even put up what they call a blind, make them out of corn shocks or willows. These live decoys, those colors, they could see a lot better than in person. They'd look around, they could see ducks maybe a mile or two off. As soon as they'd see ducks over there, they'd start flopping their wings and calling them. make an awful racket. Well, these ducks, these wild ducks, flocks, them would come over there and circle around. These other ducks, they'd just call them right in, you know, they'd just honk and quack and flap their wing, and those others would make a circle or two. They'd come down. They generally didn't light them. It wasn't hardly considered the right thing to do to let them clear a light. They thought kind of, the hunters and the regular professional, they thought that was kind of taking undue advantage of them. They wouldn't let them get clear down in the light, generally. Generally, they'd just take them down when they'd get down so low, they'd shoot maybe two or three hundreds out of each blind. You was allowed to use six shells in the gun, and later, you know, you had a plug gun, an automatic or a pump gun, and they put a plug in it, you could only use three shells. Well, then you could use all six shells. You take 200, say, in each blind, you get a big bunch in that way. It wasn't nothing uncommon to put down maybe a dozen or 15 in one round. If you've ever seen a good professional duck shooter, I've seen a flock of good ducks come over in one guy. I've seen them have three falling in the air before the first one hit the water. Bling, 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 like that. You know, it's just falling on us. Boy, that was really wicked to see them guys shoot that way.
Did you ever use live decoys?
Sure, I had a lot of live decoys.
Did you raise them?
Yes. I had about 50. English callers and other kind, and regular mounters too. I had English callers playing. If I could pick them up, hold their wings together, and get their body, because they wasn't much bigger than pigeons. And when I see a wild duck coming, I'd throw them just like a baseball. And as soon as they, just like a parachute, when I'd throw them, and they'd walk 30 or 40 feet, and then they'd start flying, you know. And they'd make a big circle and come back to the other decoys that was anchored out with an anchor on the foot. Some used the anchor on their neck, but I never liked that. I always used a foot, and what we call a boot. It's a leather strap, and this had a round ring in it to hook your snap in and the weight on the bottom. That muskrat house was built out of reeds and stuff like that, and it looked like an Indian village. It'd be a muskrat house every 100 feet. And up high, I used to stand behind them and shoot ducks. Never think of a blind. I'd lay my gun on top of the muskrat house and lean up against the muskrat house, get on the leeward side, because the duck always comes in against the wind. Got a many a duck on Anderson Lake standing behind the muskrat house.
When you used to take the men out duck hunting, did you duck hunt on the river or in the backwater areas?
No, I used the backwaters, the lakes.
Did you ever, were you ever involved with a duck club?
One of the biggest and best was the Chicago Gun Club that had Anderson Lake leased in, and that was before we had hard roads. My dad had a good motor boat, and I had that big net boat. They'd come in here on a train, the old CP in St. L, long before the CNIM bought it. And I'd pick them up at the depot when the train would get in here at about 5 o'clock at night, take them and their trunks and all their paraphernalia down to the clubhouse, which was about 12 miles down the river, and then you had to go through a slough from the river across the foot of Anderson Lake to the clubhouse. Well, I knew every one of the members. They all liked me, and I hunted with a lot of them, so I was a non-paid member of the Anderson Lake Midland Gun Club. Go down and hunt any time I wanted. Pick them up at all times.
We'll be back faster than you can reload a Winchester Model 12. Right here on the Flyway.
Homemade is great when it comes to biscuits, but not the boat blinds that's going to hide you from ducks and geese. Two things about building your own boat blind. Either it'll fit or you're going to throw one. Don't throw a fit. Call Pop-Up Blinds in Columbus, Nebraska and talk to Jeff Molnix. When you're ready to buy the last boat blind you'll ever need, give a call to Jeff and discuss it. 402-276-1424, and Pop-Up is our sponsor for this half hour of 870 The Flyway. Thank you, Jeff. You know, duck and goose decoys, truly an American art form, and the basis of a hobby that can be as casual or as intense as you wish. I know a lot of you who are listening have at least a small collection of decoys or calls or other gear as mementos of the days that we spend in the field. I do too, but none of them are worth a lot, but they mean a lot to me. Some of you are serious hardcore collectors, and no matter what your level of interest, coming up soon in Minnesota is an opportunity for decoy fans and even just ordinary duck hunters to see thousands of these vintage, unique, and valuable decoys under one roof. I'm out of breath. I'm going to catch up here and turn it over to Mr. John Southworth, the president of Minnesota Decoy Collectors, to kind of give us the scoop. John, tell us about the show, and I'll catch my breath and have my voice back by the time you're done.
Okay, Gordy, thanks a lot. Mm-hmm. Welcome, everybody. My name is John Southworth. I am the president of the Minnesota Decoy Collectors Association. Our group has been around since the early 1960s when a small group of guys who all kind of found out accidentally that they all kind of enjoyed collecting a few old duck decoys that they either used or their grandfather or father used. And they were all avid duck hunters. And they decided to let's start a little group and we'll meet at different folks' house, different guys who are interested in having us over, and we'll just talk about them and learn about them. And then, of course, that has expanded over the years. And of course, now we go to hotels and things like that. We get exhibit halls. We also have what we call a great part of the shows are what we call room-to-room trading. And really, what it is guys will come to the show, they stay at the hotel, they put all their decoys that they're interested in selling. They'll put them on their beds. They'll put them on the nightstands. They'll put them on chairs. They'll put them anywhere. And they open their door. And if you're interested in walking into their room to look at what they have available, you're free to do so. Ask questions. That's how we all learn. And that's why we did this years ago, was because we all wanted to learn more about decoys, whether they be contemporary, newly carved ones, who made it, where, and when did he make it? And all the way back to very old decoys from the 1800s. All of those, you'll see all of those at the show. You will definitely see new contemporary carvers all the way back to very old birds. There's factory decoys, handmade by just individual decoys. Those are basically the two, you know, factory, hand-built, and then, of course, contemporary, which means, obviously, like a lot of our new contemporary carvers today, carving something that they might introduce it to our show and at our show and say, this is what I just carved. Someday, of course, we hope that that'll be still around and it'll be 50, 60 years old, and someone's going to say, I just found this antique decoy. So that's why we do it. We want to learn all we can about decoys. We want to get people excited about the hobby. And one nice thing about decoy collecting, and some people, I know people like to talk about, wow, did you see that decoy for $50,000? Or did you see that decoy for $10,000? Believe me, folks, that isn't the way it always is. You can go out and find various nice quality decoys at antique stores, estate sales, garage sales. And really the best place to go is the decoy shows, because at our show, for example, we'll probably have about 110, 115 tables where folks will be selling. And you're going to see probably in that show, with that amount of people exhibiting things, you're going to see several thousand decoys of all different types, the old factory all the way up to modern contemporary carvers. And obviously, they're all different prices, but you don't have to be loaded down with cash to come to a decoy show. It's just not that way. You can find some wonderful things and something that really interests you, or it might grab at your heartstrings, and you can buy it, take it home, and enjoy it. And maybe that'll get you started and in a hobby that you might want to just continue on. And someday you'll look around and say, geez, I got 50 decoys, or I have 100. And believe me, that isn't hard to do. Sure. In my collection right now, I've got over 500.
Oh, wow.
And believe me, I don't have the most. There's guys that have over 1,000. One friend I know has over, he has almost 3,000.
Wow.
And he's, you know, and the thing is, he collects a variety of things, and mm-hmm. he doesn't really have one particular thing he buys. He'll buy whatever he really likes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And another tip for all of you folks, you know, they say, well, yeah, but what should I look at or what should I buy?
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's personal choice. When I first started out, I was going to antique stores, et cetera. And then I finally went to my first decoy show back in 1983. And I found an old Wisconsin bluebill drake that, you know, it had been around. It had been used. And by golly, I bought it for $35.
Uh-huh.
And I still have that decoy. And that's the one that kind of got me interested in all this. And, you know, the bottom line is you go to the show and you say, well, you know, I don't really care for that type of look, or I don't care for that. Well, maybe mm-hmm. you only want to collect diver duck decoys mm-hmm. or puddlers, or maybe you want to go to factory birds.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Missouri or Missouri, I should say, you got the Jefferson City decoy factories that were down there. The Benz factory and Gundelfinger.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you, those are Hayes. Some fantastic Hayes. Let's mm-hmm. not forget Hayes.
Yep.
And they're great decoys. And again, it's a factory bird. It's from the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And you can pick and choose. You can say, you know what? I'd rather collect East Coast decoys. Okay. There's Midwest. There's East Coast Southern decoys. There's Canadian birds, Michigan, Wisconsin, California. My love is the Midwest birds. I tend to like, I like the Jefferson City decoys. I like Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Canada. I love a lot of Canadian birds.
Well, no wonder you have hundreds, John. just to cover a few of each of those things would be hundreds. So. Let's take a break here, and we'll be right back. And I want to talk about a little bit more about the regional aspect of it, and especially about Minnesota. This is 870 The Flyway. We're with John from the Minnesota Decoy Collectors Association, talking decoys. And we'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Barney Caleb, and you're listening to 870 The Flyway Waterfowl Podcast.
We're back, 870 The Flyway, and we're talking with John from the Minnesota Decoy Collectors Association, who has a show coming up, and you'll be hearing more about that here elsewhere on the program. It seems like that you can't swing a cat without running across a Minnesota decoy of the vintage models. I mean, there was, and also the commercial ones you had. Herders, you know, that put out, you know, hundreds and millions of the world's best decoys that were ever made.
That's right.
Just ask Mr. Herder.
That's right.
Everybody, I think everybody knows what that means. He was a P.T. Barnum of the outdoor gear world, and that's what a character. But I digress.
Quite a businessman.
Yeah. But the decoys, there's so many decoys that come out of Minnesota, and so unusual ones. I mean, was that just a response to the fact there were so many people that did hunt there because of all the water and the birds raising there, John, or is there another reason?
Well, I'll tell you, Minnesota duck hunters, I mean, you look back at the era and you go back, many years, over 100 years, where they've been hunting ducks here since the late 1800s. We know that. And at the time, you got to remember everybody's economic situation. If you had fellas that didn't have a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
They figured, you know what, I've got some wood, I've got some paint, I think I'll try to make my own. And this is what they did. as well as by birds that were available at the local hardware stores and things like that. For example, in Michigan, there was a lot of big decoy companies, the Mason Decoy Factory and the Dodge Decoy Factory and the Peterson Decoy Factory. And they provided an awful lot, as well as a little later on in, you know, in the 20s, that's when Jefferson City birds started being produced, as well as a lot of factories down in the Mississippi area. They produced probably the most decoys for duck hunters across the entire U.S. Because they were very inexpensive, fast to make. They lathed them all, and that was it. But a lot of guys still, they couldn't go out and perhaps pay 20-some bucks a dozen for a factory decoy. So they decided to do it themselves. And just like Herders, when George Herders started his company, he started making decoys in the 30s. And needless to say, he was extremely successful through marketing. And of course, he had some pretty good stuff, and it was reasonably priced. But then again, you still had your backyard carvers who said, I can do better. Mm-hmm. And you take guys like John Tax from Osakis, Minnesota. He was a harness maker, and he made decoys out of canvas and stitched them together. And they're very unusual specimens, but he also made a lot of beautiful wood ones.
Okay. And do the canvas ones survive today, John?
You know, they do. And in fact, there's quite a few of them running around. Uh-huh. I don't mean to say they're everywhere, but it's surprising when you do run into them, and they're usually in pretty decent condition because guys used to, like everything they owned back then, they were expensive and they took care of them.
Right.
And John Tax made some beautiful field goose decoys that are extremely collectible. Mm-hmm. And then you've got people from Mankato area, Mankato, Minnesota, the Gresser family. Mm-hmm. And you've got people from down in the southern part of the state, the southeast part of the state, that manufactured or made decoys. There's a broad spectrum of carvers. Doug Lodemeyer is a member of our association, and he has done several books on Minnesota duck decoys. And I'm telling you, I never thought there were that many carvers and makers of decoys and duck call makers in Minnesota, because usually the only ones I ever heard of were, like you said, Herders, Tax, Gresser. That was about it. And oh my gosh, he had enough to fill two big books that are about 2 inches thick.
I have those. So actually,
amazing.
Those thanks to his largesse, and my gosh, they're amazing. And if anybody is into decoys, Minnesota or otherwise, get Doug Lodemeyer's books. If you don't mind me plugging his book on your association show, we got a 2-minute warning here from my engineer. We're going to have to kind of wrap this up. John, tell us again when the decoy show is, where it is, and a little bit about what they're going to see there. And
you bet. You bet. Ahead. Well, I'll tell you what, it's going to be at the Minneapolis Airport Marriott, which is on American Boulevard East in Bloomington. It's a suburb of the Twin Cities. It's right near the Minnesota St. Paul MSP Airport. Mm-hmm. And we do expect we're going to have a show on Friday and Saturday. That'd be the 3rd and 4th of February. Mm-hmm. And then 2 days prior, on the 1st and 2nd of February, we're going to have room-to-room opportunities. The fellows will put their decoys and their wares out in the room, and they'll open their doors, and you're free to come to the hotel, walk into the rooms, and you can talk to them, you can learn from them. Mm-hmm. Ask questions. If you have some old decoys you maybe want to bring to find out what this one is, or you know, and perhaps a valuation of it, feel free to do that. Mm-hmm. Even if you're interested in selling it, somebody might be there who'd be willing to purchase it from you. We're looking for a good crowd. Our exhibit hall on Saturday and Friday should be about 110 exhibit tables that'll be full of decoys and other hunting paraphernalia. So it'll be an awful good time for any outdoorsman to come and have a great time looking at decoys and everything else related.
Well, and the ordinary average Joe is welcome that may not know all about the decoys or know what a Mason decoy or et cetera.
Absolutely. Yes. Your opportunity to learn and to watch and look and handle decoys and get an idea what this whole hobby is about, and hopefully it'll bite you and you'll get the bug.
If I don't think there's a duck hunter out there that hasn't at least at some point in his career found a decoy maybe in the marsh or something and put it up on the mantle, or had one from their dad or their granddad, which is what I collect, but means a lot to them. There's just something about having that connection there to spark the memories of being out on the lake, the marsh, in the goose pit, wherever you find waterfowl.
Come and enjoy it. Have a great time and a lot of good people there.
Well, thank you, John, for sharing that with us.
Hope to see you there.
On 870, The Flyway.
That's it for our first issue of 870 The Flyway. Special thanks to Barney Califf, Colin with Califf. Don't miss his column in the magazine. Coming out at the end of February, Barney's always got something good to teach and also some interesting things to say. Michael Harrison from McGee, Mississippi, thank you for the story about your lanyard of calls and bands that was recovered amazingly the other day. What a story. Green Wing was brought to you by the goodness of Ducks Unlimited. This was an old movie that they produced years ago and part of their R3 retention program effort, and we adapted a short 3-minute theater from that. Old Timer Tales with Clyde Bell. Thank you so much to the Illinois State Library, especially to Tracy Pearsall for doing a lot of legwork for us. And finally, John Southworth of the Minnesota Decoy Collectors, talking about their show coming up on January 31 through the 4th of February. That's real soon, guys, so get to Bloomington, Minnesota and see those decoys. It's a great show. You don't want to miss it. For all of us here at Duck Hunting Traditions Magazine and at 870 The Flyway, join us again next time, and good hunting. And if you've been listening in your pickup, thanks for the ride.